We are talking with the adventurist, the author, Robert Young Pelton. One of his other books is called Come Back Alive. And so we're going to take your calls when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're going to take your calls this hour with Robert Young Pelton. Robert, the episodes that we've been talking about and the possibilities of Saudi Arabia and Iran, when could things happen? Sooner than later?
Well, it takes a while to build up a military offensive, and Saudi Arabia has been building up and practicing in Yemen. The Emiratis began building their army in 2009, and you remember the whole reflex response and Eric Prince sending Colombians to... So they've all been building their military, getting ready for something, because obviously poor little Qatar and the other enemies they have aren't that big. Now, in terms of how would they physically do it, Dick Cheney had plans for just basically missiles and bombs and Air Force-related things and no ground troops. And then they were training dissidents up, hoping that they would go into Iran and start causing trouble. So right now, I would imagine that they would start by grabbing islands or doing something that was considered aggressive, but not putting a lot of troops into Iran, which would then force Iran to make the first move. But a few minutes ago, the Saudis were saying that the missile that was launched towards Riyadh is an act of war. So they've already stated that they're at war with Iran.
Now, there was a missile that was launched. Who sent it? Who knows? But what do you think its purpose was?
It was to send a message. It was an inflammatory message that we can hit your airport if we want to.
But they took it down. The Saudis knocked it down, didn't they?
Well, we don't know if that's true or not. I mean, there were apparently five missiles fired, and if you look on Twitter, you'll see videos of missiles being fired. There's five of them going off.
From where?
And, well, from right on the border with the southern border. And then you look at some other video, and you see them. Some of them actually hitting in Riyadh. So remember, you're not dealing with an open society in which they're reporting
social
media.
Exactly. We don't have cameras there, just at a whim.
Right.
Wish we did.
But the problem is that this war is basically a reflection of that same Cold War mentality that has been adopted by a small group of people that, you know, was inflamed when they grabbed our embassy staff and held on to them for 444 days.
That's right. Is this
so we refuse to engage Iran on any other level.
Is this corruption scourge that's happening, does that have anything to do with Iran?
Yeah, those are people that are going to get in Salman's way when he wants to enforce his will. Remember, he's a young guy. He's 31 years old.
Right.
So he's got a big task ahead of himself to shift off of petroleum and also create some of these industrial free zones like Dubai, you know, like you've seen in Abu Dhabi. And then he's also got to flex his muscles regionally. He's spending a lot of money on weapons and the little sultanates of Emirates. You know, they're our largest weapons customer. It's hard to believe that, but these little countries are getting overly weaponized for something.
Now, he's not the king yet, right?
Well, he's running the country.
He's the acting, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, normal succession would be by brother, and he is now basically in charge. The question is, you know, did the people he arrested, because don't forget, in September, he arrested dozens and dozens of clerics, which you kind of heard about, but it wasn't a big deal.
That was quiet.
But going after the businessman sends a distinct message that, you know, you will not brook any dissent with the decisions I'm about to make.
So you don't think he was friends with Alawid, huh? Prince Alawid?
Well, Ali is very westernized, and I don't know anything about any accusations about bribery or corruption. I mean, these people are in the Ritz-Carlton. But it's like when you know there's a palace coup, and there have been a lot of palace coups and intrigue in Saudi Arabia. So he has an intelligence service that probably pointed out the people you better watch out for, and he made
you
this
got
move.
It. That's, now we're getting to something, because
yeah.
I don't think this was just corruption, because this is the Saudi way. It's been going on since the beginning of time.
Exactly.
I think it's something bigger than that. I think some people probably tried to get rid of him, and he picked up on it. He got wind of it.
Yeah, so think of it. I mean, the elders and the people that control the money are Wahhabists. They're very conservative, very old-fashioned people. But yet you have the seething youth bubble that causes Arab Spring, you know, across the Maghreb and into the Middle East. He has to address that, or else they will have revolutions in the streets.
Let's go to the phones now. East of the Rockies, Al's in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Al, go ahead.
Yes, I would like to ask your guest, how does he propose to win against 1,600,000,000 advocates of the Sharia law? Even if you take 1%, that's 15 million spread out all over the world.
Well, I don't think he's advocating attacking any of them, but go ahead.
No, I think you're misinterpreting what I'm saying. I'm saying that we have to get along with this people, whether it's, you know, Indonesia or whether it's Iran. They are part and parcel of the world we live in. I'm saying that we focus in on certain regimes. We favor some, like the Saudis, who are, you know, you could say arguably responsible for a lot of the problems that we see today, and we ignore others. So bottom line is that we live in a world in which we have to deal with all people.
Let's go to Marco in Stockton, California, first-time caller. Marco, welcome to the program.
Hey, George, how are you doing?
Good,
today?
Marco.
I listen to your show every night, man.
Thank you.
I wanted to know where ISIS was, like, originated from. Like, what's the backstory of ISIS? Like, how did it all come together?
Did it all start when we went into Iraq? How did it start, Robert?
Well, there was an interesting point in which we had to sign a status of forces agreement. And you remember the Iraqis were not very happy at us after Mr. Square. You know, we had an incident in which 17 civilians were killed by State Department guards.
Right, right.
And we wanted to negotiate a military agreement that would allow our troops to stay there and continue supporting both the Sunni and the Shia military units. We were essentially kicked out and said no. And then what happened was there was a huge power vacuum. And that power vacuum was in the Anbar region along the Euphrates River, which runs, as you know, sort of northwest and goes into the critical areas in Syria. So those Anbari tribes, the same people that were fighting the insurgency, then welcomed in what we now call ISIS to protect themselves. And you remember one of the very first things that ISIS did was just slaughter Iraqi troops en masse. And these were Shia battalions that had been sent up there, and they didn't want them there. So that was the very strong statement. And then when they went into Syria, they were going against Assad, and they were hoping to carve out an area that would be safe for Sunnis in that region. So I won't say that we created it, but when you create a power vacuum and you flow weapons into that power vacuum, you're asking for some type of Frankenstein insurgency to emerge.
How many people do you think have died in all these insurgencies, civilians and otherwise?
Honestly, I don't know. I could sit down and try to calculate it out, but it's actually not that many. Syria is a horrific place. I mean, Syria has
devastated
hundreds of thousands of people have died there. And places like the Philippines is not that much. And in Libya, it isn't big enough to make the headlines, but it's in a small place. When I was in Syria, you know, when they were fighting ISIS, the devastation is astounding. If you go to Raqqa, if you go to any city that ISIS has occupied, it's flattened. There's nothing there. So it's not so much the cumulative numbers, it's the intensity of violence that is perpetrated on the civilians.
Next up, let us go to Frank in Hollywood, Florida. Frank, go ahead, sir.
George, it's Maryland.
All right.
Maryland. My question is, let's go back 2 years in Syria. When those chemical weapons were used, it's hard for me to digest that it was done by the Syrian government. Did some elements, maybe ISIS or maybe even some of the Kurds, did they do this and put it on Assad? Or And then what will become of Syria? The country is devastated. The Syrians have no oil. And the Russians aren't going to pay $100 billion to rebuild those cities. So what's going to become of Syria? But first, comment on who really was behind the chemical weapons that were used. And if ISIS had them, wouldn't they use them and go out in a blaze of glory?
Well, both sides use chemical weapons. And one of the reasons they use chemical weapons is that they're a low-hanging, like fog or chemical that goes into bunkers and to buildings. And you remember we had the red line, the famous red line, that we said that if you do it again, you know,
that's
you'll
it.
Cross the
curtain
line.
Time.
And then they did it again, and then they did it again. And then we realized this was actually a way to sucker American forces into Syria, which would be more horrific than Vietnam or Afghanistan. So we wisely backed off, and then we also trimmed our support to what we call the moderate rebels. But they were isolated incidents. I mean, there was a report a few weeks ago about chemicals being used. They're very hard to handle, and you have to know what you're doing. When I was in Chechnya, they were using chemical weapons, and the people that actually handle them don't want to touch them because if there's a problem, they all die.
That's right. In just a small problem, they die.
Yeah, exactly.
With those kinds of chemicals. All right, let's go next to Gavin in Pendleton, Indiana. Welcome to the show. Hi, Gavin.
Thank you.
Sure thing.
I'd like to ask you that, do you think it's true that ISIS and ISIL and maybe Al-Qaeda was started by and maybe even funded by the CIA, maybe as an excuse to for all the wars that we're in over there?
We talked a little bit about that earlier, that we may have started them in Syria to get Assad out, but go ahead, Robert.
No, we definitely pumped, the U.S. pumped in $3 billion and Saudi Arabia pumped in $3 billion into Pakistan. And Pakistan had the training camps on the border with Afghanistan. We encouraged people to come from all around the world, get trained up by the Pakistanis, and go massacre the Soviets and the Afghans. And so we spent almost a decade creating these groups, and these are the same groups we're fighting now in Afghanistan and Pakistan and all around the world. So yes, we didn't specifically create Al-Qaeda, but we definitely got Saudi Arabia in there to help us create these violent groups. So I'd say yes. ISIS was more of us creating a power vacuum, and we don't necessarily have to take responsibility for every power vacuum in Iraq, but it was definitely our fault that we created the conditions that led to the support of ISIS. So if you sit down and you do your history and you go through time, you find that when you see a lot of weapons and you see a lot of desperate people, you see these groups are formed, and it's usually because of some large countries' covert or clandestine operations there.
How bad is the lone wolf situation?
Well, I personally think that mental health, even though it doesn't sound very sexy, is a big problem these days. And I don't mean that you and I and everybody suddenly is going crazy, but I'm saying there's a lot of pressure.
There's a lot of people that are.
And there's a lot of intense media attacks on your psyche. And I'll give you an example. Like if you just walk outside, turn your damn phone off, don't watch the TV, don't read a newspaper, and just go out and talk to the next person on the street. Life is normal. It just doesn't seem that scary. But if you go back into your house and you're watching your tweets and your news and your whatever, you're thinking the world's coming to an end.
Yes.
And I think this is a contributing factor.
Well, I am sure people in other countries, when they hear stories of 26 people killed in a church, 58 people killed in Las Vegas, they think America's probably disintegrating from within.
Well, that's a lot of dead people, I have to say. I mean, even though it sounds isolated, that's a lot of dead people, even for places like Russia and China and whatever. So we can't minimize that. But at the same time, that is machine guns into your brain from the second it happens for months afterwards. And it's always divisive. It's never sort of unifying that here's how we solve it. So this is what I see is a lot of pressure. People in debt, people, you know, slaving, working two jobs, the wife's working, the kids are at home. So just a lot of pressure, and this doesn't help. And then under the Trump administration, you know, they've adopted a tone of diversion. So there's always something on fire that you're looking at while you're not watching it, what they're really
right.
doing.
So right.
They've developed this process, which, fine, they're doing big things in the background, but it still makes people nervous.
Michael in Virginia Beach, Virginia is with us now. Michael, go ahead.
Thank you, George.
Sure.
Robert, the reason we appreciate George is his fairness in allowing both sides to be heard on major issues. The most dangerous issue in the media right now is the debate over Uranium One. Now, I think that while parties on the right-wing radio are sincere in wanting to support Donald Trump, I think they're doing a great disservice in the process to our entire intelligence establishment. They are slandering them. The Uranium One deal was being advocated by everyone, including the most critical people, most critical of it right now. It was being advocated during the Obama administration because they were saying if something isn't done to stop Iran from enriching its own uranium, Israel is going to take out Iran. We're on the verge of World War III. That's what we were told. Now we get the deal, which has Russia enriching the uranium to stop World War III, and these same voices are telling us that this was treason.
What do you think of that, Robert? And, of course, this deal, let's quickly say the Obama administration approved the sale of a Canadian mining company that had significant U.S. uranium reserves to a firm owned by Russia's government, and right. all heck broke loose.
The catch is that that is for resale inside the U.S. So my opinion on these sort of divisive political things, and I'm not either pro or against Clinton or Trump, what I will say is, these are all red flags and red herrings waved by the media to get people arguing, and then when people chew the flavor out of it, they move on to something else. We have much bigger problems in America than what Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or President Obama did, and these can all be solved by judicial process, right? So there's nothing on fire. There's no conspiracy. You know, the Russians didn't throw the election and bribe the Electoral College. We are entering into an area where we have to be very careful that we don't ignore some of the conflicts we're getting into, some of the things like infrastructure. Do you see anybody arguing about infrastructure? No. I mean, so just be careful of these divisive tactics where they're waving something over here and you really need to be looking over there.
I was just reading several books on JFK and the things they did in Illinois to get votes. Unbelievable. But we didn't have the kind of media that we have today. We didn't have the instant social networking. Those people got away with all kinds of things.
Right, but keep in mind, there was a time that media serviced both sides of the fence, right?
Yes.
So, you know, now people go right down to the special interest. I mean, you know, Fox is on this side, CNN's on that side, you know, and so HuffPost's over here, Breitbart's over there. And people start living in bubbles. They don't read or watch CNN because they're lefty pinkos. They don't read or watch anything to do with Breitbart or Fox because they're right-wing. So this is doing a disservice to the American public.
Well, the media has become an advocate as opposed to impartial. And so if you want to get your right-wing news, you know where to go. If you want to get your left, you know what to do. And it's unfortunate you can't just go to one source and have it. We'll be back with final calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Our final segment with Robert Young Pelton. And of course, Robert, what's your next exploration? What are you up to these days?
I'm sort of commuting to Libya and back, and I have to make another trip to Afghanistan. So I'm burning up those 13-hour flights is what I'm doing.
What is Libya like these days without Gaddafi?
It's kind of sad because everybody's waiting for the revolution to give benefits, you know. The dinar is, I think it's like 8 or 9 to the dollar now, so they have no money. The money's still locked up by the UN and the various people who are supposed to be saving Libya are not really saving it, so they're just waiting.
Are they still pumping out oil?
Yeah, they've got oil, but they're selling it cheap and fast. it's unfortunate because there's only 2 million people there, and it's a very wealthy place. I mean, when you drive around, it looks like any other modern Middle Eastern country. There's a lot of devastation, but the people are just trying to get back to what they have, and they should be able to survive quite well on, like I said, the oil revenue. But the UN and the EU keep messing with their governmental systems. So.
How did the mob finally get to Gaddafi? How did that happen?
Well, you know, it's funny because he's from Sirte, right? He was born in a tent just south of Sirte, and so he was always hanging out in Sirte. And they were looking for him and looking for him, and there he was sitting in Sirte. But he made a dash for it, and I think a drone picked him up. And I was with the guy, with the guys that killed Gaddafi, and I was having dinner with the guy that was displaying Gaddafi's body in his cooler, in his meat cooler.
No.
Yeah, of course. And you know, Libyans still they reminisce about this great country of Libya. They haven't really experienced any other type of existence. And it was very similar to Iraq, where after the war, they remembered how actually nice and easy it was when they had this dictator making all the decisions.
That's right. What did they hate about Gaddafi? Why did they want him out?
Well, if you were on Gaddafi's good side, you got all kinds of benefits. You know, you got free cars, you got the house, whatever. If you're on his bad side, you ended up in a ditch somewhere.
Yeah.
It was no gray area. And the same thing under Saddam, of course. I mean, I spent months just logging mass graves in Iraq, driving around in a red Bentley.
Well, and Saddam's sons were insane, weren't they?
Of course. And you could say that sort of about Gaddafi's son, but Saif is back, and he wants to be part of the government. So, you know, there is hope, but the problem is that we just ignore these people because, you know, we've destroyed their country, and we just sort of move on to the next one. And it's creating actually a larger and larger number of countries, like Yemen is destroyed, right? Libya is destroyed. And that's why when we talk about going into Iran and places like that, I just think of Syria as yet another destroyed country, right?
Let's go to Wayne in Chicago now to get things started in this segment. Wayne, go ahead.
Hey, thank you, George, and thank you for your guest.
You're welcome, sir.
Yes, you know, Gaddafi, he was taken out. The primary reason is because he was getting ready to establish a brand new currency for the whole continent of Africa, and he was going to back that currency with gold. So that was a no-no to the powers that be. That's the number one reason why he got taken out. But I want to talk about Syria for a minute.
All right.
Not too long ago, the UN came out with a story saying Assad was guilty of the sarin attack against the civilians, the gassing attack. That is a fabrication, right along with the United States fabrication about Syria. Here's the proof, George. You have a member of parliament by the name of Aaron Erdem, E-R-E-N, that's his first name, second name, E-R-D-E-M, Aaron Erdem. He showed proof that the sarin gas was being shipped from Libya, being smuggled through Turkey, given to ISIS inside Syria. ISIS was cooking up this sarin gas in Syria, and they were the ones who were dropping it on the civilians, not Assad. The Western powers were using that as a excuse to want to invade Assad and take over. And here's another thing before I hang up. They are killing ISIS in the northern part of Syria, Iraq. Mm-hmm. But in the southern part of Syria, United States, as I speak to you right now, is still supporting ISIS, along with Saudi Arabia, along with Qatar, along with Israel. So that's the real truth. Something's got to be done about this. The thing that needs to be done is we need to stop supporting these terrorist groups and mind our own business.
Let's get your reaction to all this, Robert. Thanks, Wayne.
Well, the allegiances in Syria are shifting, of course. You know, one group can call themselves al-Nusra one day, and then the next day they can be moderates, and then the day after that they can join ISIS. And so there are multiple small units fighting in Syria. In Libya, it's the same thing. You have small groups of people surviving, you know, and what they want to do is stop fighting. And the point is that the reason there's a war in Syria is because we instigated what was a peaceful demonstration, we instigated that into a violent one, and that's when Assad overreacted, and that's why we've had a war there for so many years. But the caller does make a point. I mean, we don't really pay attention to these countries in detail. We see something in the news and then we react to it. And at the end of the day, we have to strategically say, where is our money best spent? You know, is Syria a threat? Should we be even messing with them? And I see us sort of adventuring because it draws attention away from our domestic problems, which are very boring, you know, education, infrastructure, health, all these kind of things. And we need to spend more time focusing on getting our own house in order.
And isn't Bashar Assad much easier to deal with than his father was?
Yeah, so, well, Bashar was the nerd, right? It was actually his brother who was supposed to take over. And then one day he decided he was going to drive his own Ferrari instead of his driver and killed himself just on that little circle as you go to the airport.
Right, right.
So they had to reinvent Bashar as the new leader, but he was actually a moderate. I mean,
he's a doctor, isn't he?
He's an ophthalmologist.
Yeah, and the eye doctor.
So he was trying to westernize, and Syria is a beautiful place. I mean, I've been there many times, and there wasn't really any sense of extremism at all anywhere. Syrians are very educated. They're very happy to have you come over and visit. But when the protests started, we instigated, and what happened is that people started getting shot, and that's when we started creating this sort of overthrow Assad thing.
My family records are in a Christian church in Aleppo, if that church is still there. I doubt if it's there.
I don't think it is. Aleppo is so horrible. If you look at the drone footage, which you can Google on YouTube, I mean, it's like World War II in Germany. It's just everything is destroyed.
Oh, my God. They just have to level everything and rebuild it one day.
Well, the old town, maybe not so much. But, yes, I mean, it's sad that it's come to this. And like I say, we seem to be obsessed with these foreign wars, and we really shouldn't be obsessed with them. They're very small wars. And we should really focus about putting our energies into fixing the problems we have right here.
Jason in Columbus, Ohio is with us now. Hi, Jace. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I wanted to ask your guest his views on the Philippines. I noticed he mentioned ISIS was in the Philippines a couple times tonight. And I want to say I've been to the Philippines several times. My wife is from there. And I was just wondering if he foresees ISIS becoming a major problem in the Philippines, and
all right,
it would be a place that's not safe for me to visit.
Okay, good question. Go ahead, Robert.
The geography is very important. So the southern part of the Philippines, what they call Bangsamoro, was actually had missionaries there in the 1400s, Islamic missionaries, and they were always a very different part of the Philippines. And so when we handed back our first colony, which was the Philippines, we combined the Muslim areas with the Christian areas, and it's a very poor place, and there are a number of groups in the islands and in the southern part there that have their own ethnic divisions as well as the religious problem with the Christians. So ISIS has drilled in there and gone to probably the most desperate in the area of Marawi, and they took a foothold. And it's taken the Philippine military, I don't know, 3 or 4 months to get rid of them. And they're theoretically gone now, but that's an example of bad governance, poverty, people with an agenda, you know, a beef against the government, with trainers and money coming over and saying, hey, we can fire this up and go to war against the government.
Let's go see Morgan in New Orleans. Welcome to the program, Morgan. Go ahead.
Well, George, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
What do you think about the 11 Saudi princes being arrested?
Well, we talked about that earlier, but at the same time, there are thousands of princes in Saudi Arabia. So these were probably the ones that would pose the biggest challenge to Salman's rule.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, he's making a move to sort of brush back people who think they can put together a palace coup or, you know, go outside and get some people to take him out. And spend 5 minutes Googling the history of the Saudi royal family, and it's like Game of Thrones. I mean, it's actually more interesting. So that's all he's trying to do. And at the end of the day, these people are probably going to have their hands slapped and be watched very carefully by the intelligence services.
And then they let them go?
Well, one of the most interesting ones they arrested was, you know, they had Bin Laden, the head of the construction company. I don't know if you caught that in the list.
No, I didn't catch that.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, he's serious. He's sending a message. And typically, unless you do something criminal, like really bad, you're just slapped on the wrist and you're told to go stay in your house and you'll be watched by security forces.
I mean, what could they have done? I mean, because it's well known in Saudi Arabia, you grease skin.
Well, it's patronage, right? The whole system there works on patronage. So, you know, the king hands out millions of dollars to the first row of princes, and then they have to hand out hundreds of thousands.
See, these,
hand out thousands, et cetera, et cetera.
Those arrested did not publicly support this new guy, and I think he's after him.
Right. So, I mean, it's just like a brushback. You know, he didn't execute them. They're not being thrown out of helicopters. So it's just a way of saying, hey, I'm in power. We caught you, you know, we read your emails or we tapped your phones and cut it out. So we'll see if it accelerates from there, but I doubt it. He's got bigger problems.
Yeah, he sure does. Let's go to Alexandria, Louisiana. Cornelius is with us. Hello there, Cornelius.
Yes, there, George and Robert Young Pelton. This is your God, Guns and Gold Man, your Bible Bullets and Beans Man in George Norrie's Army. My question for you, Mr. Pelton, I used to be a military police officer and stuff. I believe in guns everywhere and anywhere, and I just wanted to know, being a Christian too, by taking God out of everything, the Ten Commandments and stuff, that's why we have all the problems. So I'll take my answer off there. God bless you.
That's worth recording.
More of a statement, not a question, but I'll let you react.
Well, I think what he was getting at is the move towards godlessness and you know, defending the American way. But I don't really have a comment on that. I thought that was very colorful.
He's one of our regulars.
Yeah, he's good.
Well, so what about North Korea? We touched on it a little bit. You don't think that's the pressure point as much as Saudi Arabia and Iran?
Well, the reason why is that North Korea, it was a police action in the 50s, right? It's a remnant of a very ugly war that was launched to push back the communists, aka, you know, China. And it just got frozen. So we've actually been at war with North Korea ever since the 50s. And, you know, some of my friends actually practice that war every third weekend. So we have an entire military unit that practices going to war all the time. And North Korea knows that. So what North Korea has done is they've positioned very traditional rockets and artillery pointing at the population of South Korea. So it's like a poison pill. So sure, come and drop bombs on us, take out our nuclear program, and while you're doing that, you know, millions of people are about to get killed by traditional artillery. So it's a no-win situation. It's the same situation that Pakistan does with jihadis, saying, sure, India, come and invade us, and then try holding on to the tail of the tiger.
That's right.
So there's no reason. And then the other thing is China is the only lifeline to North Korea. So if China feels that there's going to be enough pressure put on it, it will make that phone call and say, hey, stop it, you know, and then stop the test, because that's really all we're talking about, you know.
Well, I think they've made that call, haven't they?
Well, we've got all our carrier groups sitting there, so obviously he didn't pick up the phone, but I'm saying it's a solvable problem. It does not require the deaths of millions.
Well, here's the other thing. Though we both agree they're not capable yet of hitting the United States,
right,
one day they will be. One day they'll have the missile technology and they'll have the nukes. Can you trust them? I mean, can you?
Well, here's the funny thing. They've been pains in the ass since the 50s. They literally haven't changed their position.
But this guy seems more whacked out than his father and his father's father.
Well, we're allowing that to happen. I mean, most of the time we don't even pay attention to North Korea. We think it's like the Onion or something when we see a speech by him. But Donald Trump has decided to focus on North Korea, which is unhealthy. And now these missile tests, they threaten Japan. Japan can deal with North Korea. I mean, we don't necessarily have to send all our people over there to defend Japan. So all I'm saying is that it's a regional war. It doesn't pose a threat to us yet. And you've got China right there, you've got Japan, you've got Taiwan, who we sell, you know, millions and millions of weapons to all the time. We don't want to stir things up there, which we can't fix.
I honest to God would send Dennis Rodman over there and say, fix this.
We'd just tell him it's President Obama.
Just send him over there and say, fix it.
Get but that's down. How silly it is. I mean, it's a frozen war, and there is a small group of people that wants to fight all those wars with Iran, Syria, you know, and let's get in there and wipe out these dictatorships. But we've already seen what happened. We look at Iraq. I mean, look at Libya. These things don't fix themselves. They don't magically spring up and become fertile democracies.
Let's go to Don in Oregon, west of the Rockies. Donald, go ahead.
Thanks, George. Hi, sure. Robert. Wondering, you said something earlier about look one way and something else is going the other way. Well, that movie, Wag the Dog, with De Niro and Hoffman.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That really opened my mind. I keep asking people, have you seen that movie? That answers all your questions. They haven't seen it. They haven't seen it at all. They just look at me puzzled.
Well, it tells it all, doesn't it?
Well, if you're talking about watching a movie and knowing what's going to happen in Iran, no. It's secondary and tertiary effects of warfare are never predictable.
But you see Iran and Syria as the pressure point right now.
Yeah, that has been the focal point of the Trump administration and the neocons. And luckily, we have very senior generals, you know, sitting in the White House, which is unusual to have that many generals. But people like General Mattis are not about to just launch off and start a war. But we've also created the tracks and we've greased them for these proxies like the Emiratis and the Saudis to do something that would be probably dumber than us launching a war.
I think you're right.
Yeah, so I'm just saying that we live in dangerous times. We're not getting away with the excuse that, oh, well, you know, we're civilized, we wouldn't do that. Wars are always caused by things we never expect.
And they always get out of hand, don't they?
Right, but we know that we've been building up to it. I mean, the World War I was predictable when you go back and read the history. World War II was predictable, you know. So I'm just saying that there has been an intensity building in the Gulf.
Well, as they say, Robert, these are the best of times and the worst of times. Up next, clairvoyancy on Coast to Coast AM.